When Republicans passed their sweeping tax legislation in 2017, Democrats rallied around the bill as a giveaway to the rich.
We can make massive cuts in the $1.6 trillion in tax loopholes out there, and I would be going about eliminating Donald Trump's tax cuts for the wealthy.
Huge tax breaks to the people who need it the least.
Well, it is the biggest tax giveaway to giant corporations in modern memory.
On day one, we're going to repeal that tax bill that benefited the top 1%.
But there was one part of the tax bill that had bipartisan support, and it focused on so-called opportunity zones. As a government policy, the idea of these opportunity zones has been around for decades. Low-income areas get special tax incentives to encourage investment. Presidential candidate and Senator Cory Booker has been a big proponent of opportunity zones as a way to inject capital in ailing cities like Newark, New Jersey, which has gotten millions of dollars in private investment under the policy.
We know that kids growing up in low-income areas actually will make less money than their peers growing up in areas that have more economic investment. And so when I was a mayor of one of America's poorest census tracts, I was mayor of Newark, New Jersey, one of my major goals every day was how can I get capital invested in my communities to create economic opportunity.
Roughly 12% of census tracts around the country are being reclassified as opportunity zones, including almost all of Puerto Rico. But economists are questioning just how beneficial these tax breaks will be to residents of low-income areas. And new reporting has emerged showing how this program has already been manipulated to further benefit the ultra-wealthy. For more on this, I spoke with Justin Elliott, a reporter at ProPublica, and Samantha Jacoby, a senior tax legal analyst with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. And I started by asking Justin to explain just what an opportunity zone is.
So this is a program that was created by President Trump's tax law that was passed back in 2017. And the basic idea is to give a series of tax breaks to people who make investments in poor areas around the country. The goal is to incentivize new investment in the areas that need it most.
And there's an interesting history to these, which we'll get into in just a moment. But let's focus on some of the latest news. We just saw Senator Cory Booker, Representative Emanuel Cleaver, and Representative Ron Kind send a letter to the Treasury Inspector General that would investigate the potential political influence on how these zones are selected. What exactly are they talking about?
Basically, they're talking about the process by which the areas that are eligible for this tax break were selected. So my colleague and I at ProPublica and also other reporters at the New York Times have written a series of stories about how several very politically connected billionaires have used their influence to get areas where they own real estate made into these opportunity zones, thereby qualifying them for this very lucrative tax break and doing it in ways that are potentially not really aligned with the original policy goals of the program.
Samantha, the idea of using tax breaks to revitalize low-income areas has been around for a while. Where did it originate? And how is the sort of legislation that we're seeing now different from its original intent?
As you said, there's sort of a long history of what's commonly called a place-based tax incentives. And the idea is by encouraging investment in areas that are historically distressed, where residents might have faced a systemic discrimination or lack of opportunity, by encouraging investment in those places, you might create widespread economic benefits, new jobs, things like that. You know, examples of those going back to early 90s are things called enterprise zones, new markets tax credits. The difference here, I think, is that the opportunity zone tax break is really centered around capital gains, which primarily flow to the top 1% of people. So by definition, these are going to directly benefit wealthy investors and may or may not have benefits for low-income residents of opportunity zones.
Before they were rebranded opportunity zones and before the Trump administration has created this new version of an opportunity zone, did these ever work in the past? Did these enterprise improvement areas or business improvement districts or whatever we want to call them, have they worked in the past, Samantha?
I think there's sort of mixed results. There's been criticisms of these types of policies that they could be sort of fueling gentrification and displacement of low-income communities in these areas. maybe they have some effect on job creation, but it's not clear whether those jobs that are created are filled by residents of these low-income areas or whether the jobs go to people from outside the areas.
I want to talk a little bit about who's benefiting more. But Justin, we just talked about the news here that there are representatives who are concerned about how these zones are being selected. But wasn't Cory Booker a big supporter of the Opportunity Zone program?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a program that has very much had bipartisan support, and it actually existed as a standalone bill before it got put into the Trump tax law. Booker has definitely championed the idea. He sometimes refers to these areas as domestic emerging markets, I think is the term he uses. And the idea, in its current form anyways, you can trace this back to Sean Parker, who's a Silicon Valley billionaire, early Facebook investor, who actually created a think tank in Washington, D.C. to push this idea, which it was ultimately successful in.
So, Samantha, let's talk a little bit about how it works here, because we're talking about things like capital gains, and probably most folks like myself will not ever come near a capital gain. So if I'm a wealthy investor and I'm looking at an opportunity zone, what's going to drive me to what, either create a business there or build an apartment building there? What type of investment are these opportunity zones trying to attract? And what's the benefit to people who have all this money to go there and invest?
So just for a little background, capital gains come from increases in value of expensive assets like stock or real estate. Typically, you know, only wealthy people have those. And you know, it's also important to know that capital gains aren't really taxed like other types of income, like wages or salaries. They're not taxed every year. Investors can actually avoid paying capital gains taxes by just holding on to their assets over time, and that itself is a big benefit. And then when they actually are taxed, they're taxed at a lower rate than ordinary income. But what this incentive actually says is, hey, you know, even if you sell your asset, we'll give you extra tax benefits if you put that gain into an opportunity zone. So the first thing is, you know, you don't have to pay that tax that you would otherwise owe until 2026, as long as you hold on to that investment in the opportunity zone for a certain number of years. And even then, when you eventually do pay that tax, you get a 15% cut. Then the really big benefit comes later. So all gain on your new opportunity zone investment can be completely tax-free as long as the investor holds on to it for at least 10 years. So what that does is that could create a really big benefit, but particularly for projects that have the highest value for investors. So just as an easy example, an investor might get a much more generous tax break for, say, high-end real estate, as opposed to investing in an affordable housing project.
Justin, you have reported on a few places where these so-called opportunity zones have really done what Samantha's laying out here, which is benefited the extremely wealthy who have invested here. One of the people we're talking about is a man named Dan Gilbert in Detroit. Who is he, and how did he benefit from this opportunity zone?
Dan Gilbert is the billionaire founder of Quicken Loans, the mortgage company. He also owns the Cleveland Cavaliers basketball team. In the last several years, he's gone on a buying spree in downtown Detroit, has sunk several billion dollars into buying up actually most of downtown Detroit. My colleague and I did a story looking at how all these areas in downtown Detroit where Gilbert owns most of the buildings have been named opportunity zones. And so one of the themes that emerged from this was that Gilbert has a number of already planned developments, including, you know, luxury residential developments, skyscraper office towers, and those are now in opportunity zones. So what we're looking at is him potentially getting tax breaks for projects that he was going to do anyways, when the entire point of the program was to incentivize new investment. Downtown has actually been gentrifying in part because of Gilbert's previous investments in the last several years. And in fact, these areas of downtown, when you look at the data, are much wealthier than the rest of the city. But those are the areas, the wealthier areas, that got named opportunity zones, where Gilbert already owns, billions of dollars worth of real estate. And part of the reason they were named opportunity zones is that Dan Gilbert's lobbyists got involved at both the state and federal levels.
And so there we go. That brings us full circle back to the question about who's influencing who and choosing these opportunity zones and whether or not they're being chosen because of political motives. Is that not right?
That's right. So the way that the law was written, there's an enormous amount of autonomy given to the governor of each state. So basically, the federal government was in charge of deciding which areas around the country were eligible to be named opportunity zones. And then that list went to each governor, who got to pick a quarter of those as the opportunity zones. And so we've seen in multiple cases, including Detroit, where there were, you know, influential local businessmen who lobbied the state, and, you know, in the end, the areas where they already owned property were named opportunity zones. So that's what happened in Detroit. And then there's been other reporting about the lobbying happening at the federal level and on the eligibility front.
Samantha, were these opportunity zones necessary? How were these created and essentially inserted into the tax law?
So as I think Justin mentioned previously, opportunity zone legislation was originally introduced in 2017 and in the early part of 2017 with bipartisan support. But then nothing really happened with it until kind of the end of the year when policymakers were considering the big 2017, you know, year-end tax legislation. That legislation was passed kind of with an extremely rushed process. You would typically expect with legislation like this to see, you know, months-long public hearings, broad expert input on all sides of different issues, similar to what happened in 1986 when there was a major tax reform effort that took, you know, years to pass, whereas this was kind of rushed through in just a couple of months. And opportunity zones were sort of slipped into it without a lot of attention being paid to it. And I think kind of as a result of that, there were a lot of holes that the Treasury Department had to fill through implementing regulations, which actually gave Treasury a lot of power to make important decisions about who can actually benefit, what types of investment can qualify. And, you know, what they could have done was add, you know, significant public protections to make sure that investments have public benefits.
So, Justin, you've looked at another community, Port Covington in Baltimore. Tell me about Port Covington and how did it become an opportunity zone?
Sure. So it actually has a lot of echoes to the Detroit case. So Port Covington is an area of Baltimore where another billionaire named Kevin Plank, who is the founder of Under Armour, the sports apparel company, has for years been planning a large mixed-use development. Part of the plan is to ultimately have Under Armour move its headquarters to this area, which is sort of largely undeveloped. And my colleague and I obtained emails from the state of Maryland showing that Kevin Plank's lobbyists got in front of the governor's office there in Maryland early on, asking for this area to be named an opportunity zone. The governor did that. And so now this area where, again, you had a billionaire who had a project that was planned long before this tax break existed, that project is now inside an opportunity zone. So when you step back from the sort of technical aspects of the tax break, which are a little bit hard to understand, what this really is at heart is just a subsidy. It's all of us as taxpayers subsidizing development in these areas around the country. So the question becomes, does it make sense? Is it a good use of our money collectively to subsidize, you know, a luxury development that was already planned before this incentive was even created? And the point of the incentive, according to the people that put it into the law, was to incentivize new investment.
And also, just based on the name of this plan, is to ideally improve the conditions of underinvested communities. But that doesn't seem to be happening. Justin, we know, as we've said, this happened in 2017 after President Trump was in office. Has his family or the Trump organization profited from any of these opportunity zones? Is there a clear link there? Sort of, again, bringing this back to the political concerns around how these are chosen.
Right. So that's a very good question, and we don't have a firm answer to it. One thing we do know is that the Kushner family definitely owns some property in opportunity zones in New Jersey. the question of whether they're going to take advantage of the tax break and what that's going to be worth are virtually impossible to answer. That's a trait of this law, which is that there's very little data collection. So even the federal government is not going to have the data to really answer the question of whether this worked as it was intended. And certainly the public is not. It's been very difficult as a journalist to report on this because there's basically no mandatory disclosure of who's using this tax break. All we have is a list of the areas where it exists. So our reporting has relied on trying to get emails from state governments and talking to sources and that kind of thing. So it's really kind of a black box.
So just to be clear, there is no requirement, Samantha, that any of these investors create investments, or whether that's properties, or there's no requirement for them to actually prove that they are there to benefit the community, i.e. there's no requirement to say if you set up a business, you must employ 50% of the local population, or you must have, if you set up a luxury condo, that luxury condo has to set aside, 20 or 30% of its buildings for affordable units. Is that correct? These investors can basically just go in and do as they please.
Yeah, that's right. Really, the only kind of actual restriction is that they have to have a certain amount of physical property located in opportunity zones. But there's nothing that says what that property has to be or what it has to do.
Or whether it has to benefit the community that it's investing in.
Exactly.
And to that point here, Samantha, we talked about the complicated role that tax incentives play here. At the end of the day, though, very wealthy investors are paying little to no tax on these investments. So that means tax revenue is being lost in these opportunity zones. Do we have a sense of how much?
Sort of. So the initial cost estimate in the 2017 tax law for these opportunity zones was pretty small. The way that the federal government estimates revenues is they look at it over a 10-year period. But that sort of gives an incomplete picture because, as we've discussed, the biggest tax benefit of this program, tax forgiveness on Opportunity Zone investments, that won't show up for at least 10 years. So it's possible that there's going to be a much higher revenue cost than it appears. And as Justin mentioned, if we don't have the data, we won't really know what the actual cost was.
I've been speaking with Samantha Jacoby, Senior Tax Legal Analyst with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, and Justin Elliott, a reporter at ProPublica. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thanks.
Thank you.